From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We don't have to imagine what it's going to look like when the court overturns Roe versus Wade. This film shows you what it looks like when abortion providers and the women they serve are forced underground.
Saturday marked the 49th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision which legalized abortions nationwide. Many fear the Supreme Court could overturn the decision this year. We'll look at the new documentary, The Janes, about a collective of women in Chicago who built an underground service for women seeking an abortion before Roe. We'll speak to the filmmakers as well as Heather Booth. Heather Booth, who helped found Jane when she was a college student in Chicago.
We created a collective called The Janes. And between 1965 and 1973, the women of Jane themselves learned how and performed over 11,000 abortions.
Plus, we go to the Pacific Island nation of Tonga as aid flights continue to arrive after a massive underwater volcano exploded, blanketing Tonga in ash and generating huge tsunami waves. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A British judge has ruled WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange can appeal a December court decision to extradite him to the U.S. Assange faces espionage charges and up to 175 years in prison for publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. His fiancée, Stella Morris, just spoke in front of the courthouse.
Certified that we had raised point of law of general public importance, and that the Supreme Court has good grounds to hear this appeal. The situation now is that the Supreme Court has to decide whether it will hear the appeal. But make no mistake, we won today in court.
Julian Assange's lawyers and advocates have warned his mental and physical health have been steadily deteriorating, and a lower court judge last year ruled Assange should not be extradited as he posed a possible suicide risk if locked up in the United States. In pandemic news, U.S. health officials say they're cautiously optimistic the Omicron-fueled surge will soon pass its peak, though many hospitals continue to be overwhelmed with patients, and the country is still averaging over 2,000 deaths per day. In legal news, a federal judge on Friday blocked the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for federal workers and contractors. The Justice Department's appealed the ruling, which could end up at the Supreme Court. The White House says about 98% of government workers have already been vaccinated. The U.S. State Department's reducing non-essential personnel at its embassy in Ukraine and has ordered family members of diplomats to leave, citing a threat of Russian military action. President Biden's reportedly now weighing the possibility of sending up to 5,000 U.S. troops to the region and deploying warships and aircraft to NATO ally countries. NATO members say they have put forces on standby. The U.S. also sent a new delivery of military equipment to Ukraine. This comes after talks between Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his counterpart, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, Friday failed to make any breakthroughs on the escalating tensions at the Russia-Ukraine border, where some 100,000 Russian troops have been amassed. Blinken is joining a meeting of European Union foreign ministers today over the crisis. In Yemen, scores of people are dead after the U.S.-supported Saudi-led coalition launched a heavy aerial assault on territory controlled by Houthi rebels. One attack Friday destroyed a prison in northern Yemen near the Saudi border, with reports of 82 killed and dozens more trapped under the rubble. Among the dead are African migrants who'd been detained while attempting to cross Yemen to seek work in Saudi Arabia. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the bombings and called for an investigation, as did families of prisoners who visited the site.
We came from Amran province on a visit to find out that the prison has been hit by warplanes. This is a crime to be added to their crimes, and this makes us more determined to face their aggression. And we want concerned bodies to investigate this.
Another Saudi-led coalition airstrike on Friday severed internet service across all of Yemen. Elsewhere, the United Arab Emirates says it thwarted an attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels intercepting two ballistic missiles fired at Abu Dhabi. This comes a week after Houthi drones and missiles killed three Emirati civilians. In northeastern Syria, more than 150 people have been killed after Islamic State fighters launched a coordinated assault on a prison aiming to free men and boys held captive by a U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish militia. The attack prompted the U.S. military to call in airstrikes from helicopter gunships. The prison remains under siege, with Kurdish fighters claiming the Islamic State is using hundreds of boys as human shields. Nearly 700 children of alleged Islamic State fighters have been held at the prison by a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia known as the Syrian Democratic Forces. Last year, a United Nations report found conditions inside the jail amount to torture, with prisoners packed into overcrowded cells and denied sunlight, medical care, and proper nutrition. In Afghanistan, at least seven people were killed Saturday after a bomb went off on a bus in the western city of Herat. Taliban leaders are holding three-day talks in Oslo with Afghan civil society representatives and officials from the U.S. and European nations. The parties are expected to discuss women's rights as well as access to billions of dollars in frozen assets and aid money. The U.N. warns foreign sanctions are leading Afghanistan to an even worse humanitarian disaster, with some 23 million Afghans facing extreme hunger and nearly 9 million at risk of famine. In Burkina Faso, President Roch Kabore has reportedly been detained by mutinous soldiers in an apparent coup. Several reports say he's being held in a military camp. Gunfire erupted Sunday at military bases in the capital as soldiers revolted, angered by Kabore's government's failure to stop a years-long wave of attacks by Islamist extremists. More than 2,000 people have died in the violence. Hundreds of protesters also took to the streets of the capital Sunday, demanding Kabore's resignation. In Sudan, prominent women's rights advocate Amira Osman was detained after over a dozen armed men raided her home late Saturday in the capital, Khartoum. This is Osman's sister, Amani.
They stormed through the door and came into the house. There were so many of them, around 15 men and another 15 outside, carrying guns and Kalashnikovs.
Osman and other women's rights advocates played a crucial role in the uprising that led to the overthrow of former President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Dozens of other high-profile political figures have been arrested since October 25th, when Sudan's military took control of the government in a coup. The Palestinian Authority is calling for an international commission to investigate a massacre committed by Israeli forces in the Palestinian village of Tantura in 1948. This comes after last week the Israeli newspaper Haaretz revealed there's a mass grave under the parking lot of the now popular Dor Beach of over 200 Palestinians executed by Zionist gangs in Tantura. 1948 marked the beginning of the violent Israeli occupation of Palestine, known as the Nakba. The chair of the House committee investigating the U.S. Capitol insurrection has revealed the committee has been speaking with former Trump Attorney General William Barr. Congressmember Benny Thompson shared the information in response to a question about a draft of an executive order released by Politico that was presented to Trump in December of 2020. The order would have directed the Secretary of Defense to seize voting machines in battleground states, among other things. In related news, the Justice Department charged a man Friday with publicly calling for the killing of Georgia election officials one day before the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Chad Christopher Stark of Texas called on Georgia patriots to, quote, put a bullet in one official. Stark is the first person to be charged under the Justice Department's Election Threats Task Force, which was created last June. The Arizona Democratic Party censured Senator Kyrsten Sinema Saturday for voting against a rules change that would have allowed Democrats to bypass a Republican filibuster and pass major voting rights legislation. In a statement, chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, Raquel Turan, said, quote, "In the choice between an archaic legislative norm and protecting Arizonans' rights to vote, we choose the latter. The ramifications of failing to pass federal legislation that protects their rights to vote are too large and far-reaching," she said. In Mississippi, every single black state senator stood up and walked out as the Republican-led Senate passed a bill that would ban the teaching of critical race theory in public schools. This is State Senator Barbara Blackmun speaking ahead of the walkout.
This bill is not morally right. I heard this gentleman say he talked to his African-American friend, and I guess everybody has an African-American friend. There are 14 black senators in this chamber, and these 14 black senators are telling you that this bill is morally wrong.
The bill passed 32-2 with the two votes against the bill cast by white Democratic senators. The Biden administration's ordered federal agencies to enact the new $15-an-hour minimum wage for federal workers by the end of the month. The change will affect nearly 70,000 workers. Biden signed an executive order raising the minimum wage for federal workers and contractors last April. Here in New York City, new legislation granting protections and rights to delivery app workers goes into effect today. The new laws were pushed by the labor group Los Deliveristas, the Delivery Workers United, and essential workers who kept the city running throughout the pandemic. They include a fair minimum wage, tip transparency, and access to restaurant bathrooms. Workers say they will continue to push for more protections. This is Councilmember Carlina Rivera, one of the sponsors of the bill, speaking at a celebratory rally Sunday in Times Square.
Just a reminder of what these deliveristas go through. Remember, many of them are not here to celebrate this moment with us. So this is our obligation, is policy making with the foundation of immigrant, environmental, disability, and gender justice.
In Northern California, firefighters have contained about a third of a 1,000-acre wildfire near the coastal communities of Monterey and Big Sur. Hundreds of residents were evacuated over the weekend. The blaze is the first 100-acre-plus wildfire in the area to burn in the month of January in over a decade, as the climate crisis and a two-decade drought have led to extended wildfire seasons. And the world-renowned Buddhist monk, poet, teacher, and anti-war activist Thich Nhat Hanh has died in his native Vietnam at the age of 95. Thich Nhat Hanh was exiled from Vietnam for decades, beginning in the 60s, after he spoke out publicly against the war. In 1966, he traveled to the United States and met with Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., helping to persuade King to speak out against the U.S. war in Vietnam. King went on to nominate Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize a year later, calling him an apostle of peace and nonviolence. Thich Nhat Hanh believed that Buddhist principles should be applied to everyday life and even to solve difficult political problems. This is a clip of an address he gave in Berkeley, California in the 1980s.
Mindfulness is the capacity to be aware of what is happening in the present moment. If we eat mindfully, if we drink mindfully, if we do things mindfully, but we are under the light of mindfulness, we know what to do in order to bring the elements of peace and joy to our body and to our feelings. We know what not to ingest in order to prevent the toxins, the poisons to enter our body and in our consciousness.
Again, Thich Nhat Hanh has died at the age of 95 in Vietnam. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Humanitarian aid flights are continuing to arrive in the Pacific island of Tonga after a massive undersea volcanic eruption blanketed the South Pacific island nation with ash, destroyed homes, and triggered huge tsunami waves. At least three people died after the January 15 blast. Shockwaves from the eruption were felt around the world. Scientists at NASA say the blast was hundreds of times stronger than the U.S. atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. Tonga's made up of about 170 islands, is located about 2,000 miles east of Australia. Communication is still cut off for some of the 36 islands where people live. An undersea telecommunications cable connecting Tonga to the rest of the world was severed by the blast. The island nation is now in dire need of food and clean water. This is Drew Havea, vice president of the Tonga Red Cross.
Dusty Nukualofa is a huge problem. People are still struggling to clean their homes, struggling to clean the roof of their houses. So everybody is, even the unaffected areas by the tsunami, are all affected by the ash.
We go now to the capital of Tonga, the city of Nuku'alofa, where we're joined by Marion Kupu, a reporter for Broadcom Broadcasting. Marion, we're so relieved to be able to speak with you. Can you describe what took place? Describe the extent of the volcano.
Thank you. I don't know how I can describe or compare what we experienced, what we've seen, what we felt on the 15th of January, that was Saturday. It was a very new experience, very scary experience that I know we will never forget. The panicking, the queuing, the confusion that the people had because we do not know or have experience or know what to do after that, during the explosion, during the tsunami, and after the tsunami, with the rocks, the ashes, and the thunder, and also to learn that some of the islands have been fully destroyed.
Can you describe what happened to you and your family? Describe January 15th, what you were doing, what you heard and saw.
We were at home, as usual. Saturday, it's cleaning day for Tonga people, and it's a day for the Tonga people to get ready for Sunday, because Sunday is it's taboo for shops to open. Sunday is just church service and staying home, having this feast. So basically, we were just at home, getting everything ready and just laying back. And then around after 5, that's when we first heard the first bang. The first thing that I can really recall was my ears ringing. It was very new. Everything else it was just blank. All I can remember was just trying, because we were very, very much aware that it is the volcano. Because since last year, we've been seeing lightning from there. We've been seeing clouds in the sky, just weird cloud colors in the sky. It would be pinkish. It would just be very new for us here in the islands to witness this. So I think it is a good thing that we've had experience or witnessed that there is, and know that there is a volcano that is very active down at the west side of Tonga, or the main island also. That as soon as the blast went off, the first blast went on, we knew exactly what to do, and we knew that there is a volcano. All we can think of is just running away from the sea, because where my village is close to the main island, and is also close, but not too close to the shoreline of where the waves came. All we did was just to drive away from the Nuku'alofa, drive away from the shore.
And then describe the impact and on the islands and what you even understand at this point, more than a week later, with the only internet line cut with the volcano going off.
Thinking back around, I'm not pretty sure if it was Wednesday or Thursday, we experienced, we woke up in the morning and smelled this very distinctive smell. It was not a nice smell. This is, I'm not sure if it was Wednesday or Thursday morning. All of the country can smell that. And we finally, throughout the day, we can make up and thought it came from the volcano. So these are the things that we now have experienced, and we can now know if we treat the volcano now that is active, right? So if a smell comes today, definitely we will be ready for another volcanic eruption in 2 or 3 days to come. So these are the signs that we have looked back and thought of it, and just it makes sense to what we have experienced with the connection or the fire optic fiber cable is down because it's laid on the seashore under the seabed, which catered all the internet connection with us here in Tonga. However, here at Broadcom, we were able to connect with the rest of the world. We were practically one of the public or private companies that ever started connecting with the first hand to connect with the world besides the embassies here. It's because we were using our satellite, and our satellite carriers is from the Kasifiki satellite company. That's how we were able. In the meantime, there is limited access to internet. We are working together with Tonga Corporation Communication, which is called TCC, a local-owned phone company.
Can you talk about the...
Which is open.
Marion, can you talk about the effect of the ash on the water supply and what kind of international aid are you getting? What do you need?
The whole country, and I mean the whole country or island, is covered with ash from the highest building to the lowest. It's covered with ash. So all our water tanks, majority of our water tanks in private homes, we gather our water from rainwater. That's our everyday drinking water, which is safe water, nice, clear, clean water. However, when ashes came and it polluted our tank and is now advised not to take. However, there is we're very fortunate to have aid coming on shore. They're coming on our shore. They're also coming in our ports, water supplies, clothing, food, and also tents for temporary shelter for those that have lost their homes.
According to the IMF, just 2 years ago, Tonga is one of the world's most exposed countries to climate change and natural disasters, suffered the highest loss from natural disasters in 2018, is among the top five over the last decade. Can you talk about volcanoes and climate change?
Every year in Tonga, we are expecting a natural disaster. Our hurricane season is from January to March, or even can extend. So every year we will be expecting a tropical cyclone. We've had experienced tropical cyclones for years, and we have overcome them, and we are always prepared for hurricane seasons with tropical cyclones. But we have never been prepared for a volcanic eruption. Here in the mainland, we will hear stories. The mainland is not even a volcanic island. The furthest island of Tonga from here is Niue's. The Niue's are closer to Samoa than here to us here in the mainland. Those two islands are the volcanic island, and they've been weeping stories coming from them from eruption. But never here in the mainland. And this is something really new for us.
And what about, finally, the issue of international aid and COVID in this era of COVID?
We treat all cargoes coming in, all the supplies or anything that lands on our country, the way we treat when we have supplies for COVID, which is we do not accept or offload passengers. Only cargoes are allowed to come out from the planes, and they are taken to a quarantine place for 3 days before we are allowed to use them or distribute them. This is also applies to our ships coming in. They are offloaded and are kept in a secured, designated place for quarantine for 3 days before we can actually use them. We do not accept we still follow the COVID because we still have to be cautious that there is COVID around in the world. I can brag that we have only had 1 week positive case here so far. But since the COVID-19, we have never had a serious COVID problem here.
And in this last 30 seconds, Marian Kupu, as you speak to us from Tonga, I think it's our first broadcast from Tonga, though we've interviewed people from Tonga when it comes to the climate crisis. What is your message to the world?
You'll be expecting, I don't think this would be the last disaster or nature disaster that the Tonga would be experiencing. Every year after year, we'll be having nature disasters. And year after year, we'll be expecting aid to come for us because we cannot control nature. But this is what we have to live for and live with. And this is normal for us here in the island.
Marian Kupu, reporter for Broadcom Broadcasting in the capital of Tonga, Nuku'alofa. Next up, Saturday marked the 49th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. Many question if the Supreme Court will strike down the landmark ruling before it turns 50. We'll look at a new documentary at the Sundance Film Festival called The Janes, about life before Roe, when a collective of women in Chicago built an underground service for women seeking an abortion. Could this be what post-Roe looks like as well? Stay with us. By the leave of this gathering, by the Tongan musicians, the Halamangauno group. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saturday marked the 49th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States. Will it be overturned by this summer as the Supreme Court signals its support for extreme restrictions? On Friday, thousands of people joined the annual Anti-Choice March for Life in Washington, D.C., and celebrated a possible end to the constitutional right to abortion. There were also counter-protests during an overnight prayer vigil by religious groups Thursday at the largest Catholic church in the country. The abortion rights group Catholics for Choice projected pro-choice messages onto its side.
Lift up the voices of the majority of Catholics in the United States who support abortion rights and do not want to see Roe versus Wade struck down. One in four abortion patients in this country identifies as Catholic. We need to start listening to them. We need to think about the human toll of not having access to reproductive health care. And as people of faith, we need to be loud and we need to be bold and take back the narrative from this right-wing Christian nationalist, anti-feminist, white supremacist movement.
Whether Roe v. Wade will mark 50 years next year depends in part on a ruling expected this June from the Supreme Court in a case called Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which challenges a Mississippi law banning abortion starting at just 15 weeks of pregnancy. On Thursday, the Supreme Court rejected another attempt by abortion rights advocates and providers to block Texas's six-week abortion ban. At least 26 states, more than half the country, have laws in place to immediately ban abortion if the court overturns Roe. For more on what life was like before January 22, 1973, ruling in Roe that gave Americans the right to abortion, we're joined by three guests. Tia Lesson and Emma Pildes are the directors of The Janes. It's premiering tonight at the Sundance Film Festival, virtually around the globe, and will air later this year on HBO. It tells the story of the Jane Collective, which was formed in 1968 in Chicago when a college student and civil rights activist named Heather Booth sought help finding a doctor to help a desperate friend who needed an abortion. Heather Booth also joins us now. This year's Sundance, which kicked off Thursday, is also featuring a dramatic film called Call Jane that stars Elizabeth Banks and Sigourney Weaver, and also features a film called Happening, about a woman getting an abortion in France in the 1960s. Three films at this year's film festival on choice, on abortion. Heather Booth, let's begin with you. You're featured in the Janes documentary. Talk about how you ended up founding the Jane Collective.
Amy, thanks for allowing us to talk about what life was like both before Roe and about what life could be like. And the key lesson we have is that we need to take action now. We need to organize. And if we organize, we can change the world. Before Roe, I was involved in the civil rights movement. I went with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to Mississippi in 1964, when Northern students were recruited to support the courageous struggle for Black people in Mississippi for the right to vote. And I learned three key lessons from that. One is that even in desperate times, that when people come together and organize, we can change this world. In the civil rights movement, we won a Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act. The second lesson I learned is you really have to act on what is morally correct. You need to try and build a beloved community, work with compassion and caring for others. And the third lesson is that sometimes you have to stand up to illegitimate authority. It's that background and those lessons that were, I think, operating for me when a friend asked me, could I find a doctor to perform an abortion for his sister, who was pregnant and nearly suicidal, wasn't ready to have a child. I found a doctor through the Medical Committee for Human Rights, the medical arm of the civil rights movement, a Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who himself had been a civil rights leader until his name appeared on a Klan death list in Mississippi, and he came to Chicago. I made the connection between my friend and that doctor, really just out of a wish to do a good deed, kind of the golden rule. You want to treat others as you might want to be treated. I've never faced the situation of needing an abortion myself or wanting it. And I didn't really think much more about it until someone else called, because word must have spread. I made the connection again, and then someone else called.
And so I set up a system. I learned much more about what was involved. And after a while, Dr. Howard was no longer available, and I found someone else whose name was Mike. And the calls kept coming in. More and more people were coming. And I was involved with, I was in grad school at that time. I was working full time. I was about to have my first child out of a movement marriage that we've had for over 50 years.
You were married to the great labor organizer, Paul Booth, before he died.
Yes. He worked with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees for over 43 years. And he had been a student leader. We actually met at a sit-in against the war in Vietnam. And at that time, I realized we need to bring more people into this. I couldn't still manage the counseling of the women who were coming through on my own. And I recruited other women and trained them in what I had learned about the procedure and how to support the women who were coming through. Over time, as more and more women were seeking this help on the most intimate decision people make in their lives about when or whether to have a child or how many children to have, at that point, the women found out that Mike wasn't himself a doctor. And they realized that if Mike could do it, they could do it. And so the women of Jane, which is what we call this building collective, the women of Jane ended up performing over 11,000 abortions between when I made that first contact in 1965 and 1973, when Roe became the law of the land. And Tia Lesson and Emma Pildes do an extraordinary job in documenting this in the remarkable movie, The Janes.
Now, Tia Lesson, your Oscar Emmy nominated filmmaker, you really, in this film with Emma, bring together how the movements come together, how the Jane Collective, as Heather was describing, came out of these different movements, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, H.R.M. Howard, the doctor who was imprisoned several times for performing abortions at his clinic in Chicago. And he himself had fled Mississippi, targeted by the KKK. Can you talk more about that?
Well, thank you, Amy. Yeah, I mean, Chicago at that time was the epicenter of so much turmoil, so much organizing. You know, it was the headquarters of the Young Lords. The Black Panther Party had an enormous chapter there. Martin Luther King came to the city in 65 and 66 to wage the Freedom Campaign. And there was also a burgeoning women's movement. And of course, in 1968, Mayor Daley's thugs beat down the protesters at the Democratic National Convention. And out of this, you know, context came, you know, so many of the Janes. You know, Heather, as she described it, was a volunteer at Freedom Summer. Patricia Novick, Reverend Novick, organized the marches in the southwest of Chicago that were so viciously, you know, assaulted by the white supremacists who lined the streets. Marie Lehner, you know, was a paralegal for Bobby Seale as part of the Chicago 8, you know, defense team. These women, forces of nature, were all, you know, the members of Jane, and many, 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 many more. They came out, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement, the civil rights movement, these were the training grounds for these women.
Emma Pildes, you are so key to this documentary in so many ways, aside from co-directing it. You were the family connection to the Janes. Talk about Judith Orcana.
Well, she, you know, she's an incredible woman that did an incredibly brave thing, as they all did. You know, I have, like you said, I have this family connection to the film. My brother, actually, who's a producer on the film, sort of, you know, looked around when Trump got into office and it seemed like he would likely pack the courts and said, we're in trouble. you know. I think part of the reason that these women spoke certainly was the family connection we had, but I think, you know, the real reason that they spoke was because, you know, they were feeling the same way that we were feeling, and they were seeing the same things that we were seeing, and they were terrified. I feel like they were likely, perhaps, you know, feeling called to duty again. As were we. You know, T and I are filmmakers. That's the arrow we have in our quiver. And, you know, we knew that this was something we could do. We could bring this story of organizing, of, you know, of bravery, of taking care of your sisters and brothers, and remind people that, you know, when things are feeling dire and you're feeling out of control and it feels like, you know, the country isn't valuing women's lives, that there's things that you can do. Jodi in the film says so beautifully, you know, they felt a need to disrespect a law that was disrespecting women. So that's always an option. And these women were incredibly brave and inspiring. So we feel really lucky to have been able to make this film.
I want to go back 2 years in Democracy Now! When we interviewed Alice Fox, a former member of the underground abortion group Jane, who talked about her own experience calling the abortion collective when she found out she was pregnant.
At that time, there was no question of me remaining pregnant. I was in a new relationship, and abortion was already legal in New York, so I knew I had enough knowledge to know that that was an option for me. And it was clearly—it was not a decision I had trouble making, that I needed to have an abortion at that time. I was fresh out of college myself. And interestingly, and I'm not sure I remember my thinking around that time, it didn't really occur to me to come to New York. I really was in an independent state of mind and felt I could take care of my own life, and saw an ad about pregnant, called Jane. And immediately I felt confident, and from that initial interaction over the telephone.
What did you say? You called up.
I
said
called
you were
that
pregnant.
Number.
And what did the person say? Who
I think it was a message. The first one was, please leave your name and maybe the date of your last period. I don't remember what the actual information was that I left on that time, but I was called back pretty promptly. I don't recall being in a state of waiting very long, and I. Then met with a counselor at that time, and she gave me all the information about what would happen, and I was in her home with her young children running around, and I felt totally comfortable, confident, not frightened. You know, I hear these stories of what the worry and the fear that what lay ahead was some nightmare. I don't recall feeling that for a moment. And I felt very proud of myself for taking care of myself.
And what happened? What did she do in this home with her kids?
So she laid out to me exactly what would happen in the procedure that I would be taken care of, that I would exactly all the steps that would happen, that I would be driven to a place that would be, that I would be safe and taken care of, that someone would be by my side the whole time, and that the procedure. Described the procedure itself, which at that time was DNC, and that I would be—I think I was taken with a group of women, so that I wasn't by myself. There was a few women, maybe Laura can correct me, but that's my memory, that there were a few people each time that procedure was scheduled. And she described the procedure in detail, which, again, was an incredibly—I don't think I'd ever been described a medical procedure before by someone saying, this is exactly what's going to happen, and I was prepared.
So that's Alice Fox, a former member of the underground group Jane, and she's referring to Laura Kaplan, another member who wrote the book, The Story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service. But the way Tia Lesson, she talks about the procedure, Heather just referred to Mike, the so-called doctor. At least people thought perhaps he was a doctor at the beginning. But tell us this character who you amazingly were able to speak to. And then we're going to talk about the arrests. And you got one of the cops who arrested the women, like Judith.
Well, listen, I mean, you have to remember that at that time, you know, in the 60s, you know, in the, especially in the early 60s, abortion was illegal in every state of the country except Hawaii. That changed, slowly began to change in 1970 when New York legalized abortion. But, you know, doctors or provide people who performed abortions, you know, risked arrest, they risked prosecution, they risked jail sentences up to, you know, 10 years per count. It wasn't simply performing an abortion that was illegal. It was actually advertising, circulating information about abortion. And so there were many doctors, you know, who were just, you know, not willing to take this risk, even in the privacy of their own, you know, offices or clinics. And those that did, many that did, charged, you know, exorbitant rates. And, you know, frankly, women were subjected to, you know, all sorts of sexual exploitation, financial exploitation, you know, they couldn't guarantee their own safety. You know, so women were risking potential injury, you know, infection and even death. You know, countless women ended up in the morgue. There were septic abortion wards in Chicago, in every city of this country. When abortion was illegal, because when abortion is illegal, it doesn't mean that women don't get abortions. It just means that, you know, women have a really hard time finding safe, you know, affordable abortions.
So perhaps it means that women still get abortions, okay. But they die.
That's right. They die. And so the provider that Heather found through doctor friends of hers was quite skilled. He was born and raised in Chicago, and he you know, was very adept at the procedure. He called himself Dr. Kaplan, and so I think the women assumed, you know, rightly so, that he was a doctor. And in fact, he was not a trained medical professional, but he was trained by a surgeon. He was a, you know, salt of the earth, very good guy. And he certainly was in it for financial reasons, for financial gain. But the Janes were able to, you know, negotiate, charm him, and also, you know, offer up some volume, and he discounted the procedure greatly. And so they were able to offer the procedure, which cost at that time the equivalent of thousands of dollars, you know, for cut rates, safe, affordable, and also, you know, protected in some cases, you know, from police until they weren't.
And Heather Booth,
we were very fortunate. Yeah,
Heather, the power of when realizing he was not a doctor, the women said, hey, then we could do this. And the idea that there were 11,000 women who got the procedure and no one died, unlike the rest of the country.
In fact, there was a study that was done after Roe became the law, comparing how safe Jane was compared to procedures that were done in established medical facilities. And Jane was even more effective than the official establishment, because Jane was a women-centered collective. It was not done for profit. It was as much of the medical system is done now. And it was done out of caring and concern and a moral commitment to the women. And we should realize how common abortion is. One in four women now of reproductive age will have an abortion. So if you see one in four, you count one, two, three, four, one of them is likely to have or select an abortion in their lifetime. So this is not rare. It needs to be safe and legal and accessible. And I want to go back to one thing that Alice Fox said on that clip that you played. She said that she didn't think of going to New York. And so she found Jane in Chicago. But in fact, people with means, people who were in middle class or in more secure situations or had family or other support, finally could go to New York or Colorado or Hawaii or abroad to Sweden and find a way to get an abortion legally. But people who were poor, people who didn't have means, who didn't have support, they had almost nothing to turn to. And we're now facing that kind of situation where women in Texas, it's 6 weeks, not only would they be denied the ability to make this most intimate decision in their life, but it's even worse than that. There's now a kind of vigilante bounty hunter rule in Texas that says that neighbor can report on neighbor and gain up to $10,000 as a bounty if you report on someone who's actually trying to make an arrangement about getting or receiving an abortion. And so this disproportionately impacts people who are poor, who are have less healthcare options available to them and don't have the kind of supports that would let them have a fuller life and full participation in the society.
Emma Pildes, I want to end with you and the arrests. What happened to the Jane Collective? The arrests didn't end it, but I mean, what the women faced, Heather was not among them at the time who got arrested. How many years in prison, accused of providing abortion or conspiracy to provide abortion?
Yeah, so it was 11 counts each of abortion or conspiracy to commit abortion with 10 years or the possibility of 10 years on every count. So each of the seven women that were arrested that day were facing 110 years in jail. So that was terrifying and a position they should never be put in. This shouldn't be on their shoulders to be providing, you know, medical care, health care, basic health care for women in this country, and then possibly be facing jail time.
And then explain what happened, of course, the significance of what's threatened today. It's not that they went to trial and they were acquitted.
Yeah, so there is, in addition to this being, you know, an incredible story and timely story, it's just a great story. There's a lot of natural drama. And one of those moments is, you know, there was a bust. They got busted and they were waiting for trial, but Roe passed. And so they were exonerated. In this same moment that women across the country were freed, the Janes were freed. But, you know, it's just heartache all around, you know, that women.
We're going to have to end, but highly encourage people to see this movie when it comes out on HBO tonight. It's premiering at the Sundance Film Festival. Emma Pildes and Taya Lesson are the directors of The Janes. Heather Booth is the founder of The Jane Collective as a student in Chicago. It will air later this year on HBO. When we come back, we speak to the fiancé of Julian Assange. A British judge has ruled the WikiLeaks founder can appeal a December court decision to extradite him to the U.S. Stay with us.
Can I have a taste of your ice cream? Can I lick the crumbs from your table? Can I interfere in your crisis? No, mind your own business. No, mind your own business.
Business by Delta 5. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's efforts to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange were dealt a setback today when Britain's High Court ruled Assange can appeal a narrow part of his case to the British Supreme Court. Assange faces espionage charges and up to 175 years in prison in the U.S. for publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. He has spent over 1,000 days locked up in the Belmarsh High Security Prison in London. Before that, over 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he'd been granted political asylum. We're joined now by Julian Assange's fiance, Stella Morris. Stella, it's great to have you back. Can you talk about the Supreme Court ruling that just came down, or rather the court ruling that just came down?
Well, the High Court had reversed an earlier decision by the lower court, which had blocked extradition to the United States. On December 10th, which is Human Rights Day, the High Court decided that it would greenlight the U.S. extradition, but we put in a request for appeal. And now the High Court has recognized that Julian's appeal arguments raise really fundamental issues of fairness, and they've certified those points so that we can ask the Supreme Court to hear our appeal. But it's not yet clear whether the Supreme Court will agree to hear that appeal.
So how does this work?
Well, the Supreme Court will now take potentially months to decide whether it will hear our arguments. But even if it doesn't hear our arguments, we still have the possibility to appeal all the other issues, all the other press freedom issues, the arguments that this is a politically driven, politically motivated prosecution, a persecution that is using the courts to further the political persecution against a publisher for doing his work, for having published evidence of that country's, of the U.S. crimes.
Can you talk about Julian's physical and mental health? We have reports of the slow or perhaps fast deterioration.
Well, Julian has been in the U.K.'s harshest prison, Belmarsh Prison, for over 1,000 days. He's only there at the behest of the U.S. government. He's not serving any sentence in the U.K., and for every day that passes, his health deteriorates further. And in October, on the first day of the extradition appeal, he suffered a mini stroke. And we're very worried that at any moment he could suffer a more catastrophic health emergency. Mini strokes, as everyone knows, can be a precursor for much worse health complications. And, you know, Julian has been deprived of his freedom, deprived of the outside world for over a decade. He was first arrested on the 7th of December, 2010, just 7 days after WikiLeaks started publishing Cablegate. And he has not been a free man since. And his health, his physical health and his mental health are obviously deteriorating because he's only a man. He's a fighter. He's a strong person, a strong-willed person who believes in the work that he's done, and he's aware that this is a fight that against a monumental injustice. But there's only so much a man can take.
Stella, since we've spoken, you had applied to be married, the two of you. The prison forbade that and then reversed their decision. And today, as you stood outside the new court ruling, you said, "Today we won, but Julian continues to suffer. Julian must be freed." Your final 10-second comment.
Well, you know, Julian, for every win that we get, Julian's situation doesn't seem to change. And this is punishment through process. And it has to end. The Biden administration should just drop this. We shouldn't have to be taking it through the UK justice system, because this is a political prosecution that was initiated by the Trump administration. And it is causing ongoing harm, not just to Julian,
we
not
have
to
leave
just
it
to
there.
Us.
Stella Morris, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman.